In Deuteronomy chapter 18, beginning at verse 21, Moses said, "And if thou say in thine heart, how shall we know the word which the Lord hath not spoken? When a prophet speaketh in the name of the Lord, if the thing follow not, nor come to pass, that is the thing which the Lord hath not spoken. But the prophet hath spoken it presumptuously, thou shalt not be afraid of him." If he makes a prediction and it doesn't come to pass, he's a liar. Don't pay any attention to him. In Matthew chapter 24 and verse 36, and speaking of the end, Jesus said, "But of that day and hour knoweth no man, no, not the angels of heaven, but my Father only. Watch therefore, for ye know not what hour your Lord doth come." That's pretty hard to misunderstand. It's pretty hard to get that wrong, and despite the clear message from Scripture. We have people that have gotten rich, very rich, scaring little children and old ladies and gullible brethren. I had a dear, sweet old aunt, Aunt May, and she was terrified by some of these doctrines of the premillennialist. She used to say with all seriousness that, "I know what those lights are at night that we see." She said, that's some Russians coming over here, and they're planting that marijuana, and they're going to get everybody on that dope and come over here and take over. And the Bible talks about that. Well, she was later converted to Christ, but she'd listened to some of these characters and was frightened by it. And it's sad. Prominent men, intelligent men. I appreciated Brother Hicks pointing out these guys are not just a bunch of goobers. They are intelligent people. The doctrine would seem so. It would seem that it makes a lot more sense if you'd abused drugs for a long time. And yet, vast majority of the religious people that you and I are kin to, that we love, that we're concerned about, are caught up in some facet of premillennialism. Many allege that current wars and natural disasters and all of those kinds of things that we see taking place, volcanic eruptions and so on, are the fulfillment of biblical prophecies that signal the beginning of the end of the world. A series of earthquakes and floods and famines and all of those kinds of things are allegedly going to be followed by the disappearance of the righteous we've been hearing about, called the rapture, and a terrible war climaxing in a horrific nuclear conflagration that Jesus is going to interrupt is going to take place. And despite what the Lord said about date setting, you have men who have gleefully continued that practice. Brother Lewis is right. It's a classic case of people not reading the Scriptures. William Miller, founder, well, he wasn't actually the founder of the Adventist Church. He never was a member of the Adventist Church, but the Adventist Church was founded on what Miller wrote. They took his stuff and founded a movement. Miller predicted the end of the world on March 21st, 1843, and it didn't happen. So he got his pencil down, had read Deuteronomy. Apparently his followers hadn't read it. Got his pencil down and refigured for the next year. Well, Miller, to his credit, was honest enough to retire from date setting. He said, I was wrong. But his followers continued to pursue that practice. Joseph Smith, the founder of the Mormon Church, also made a prediction. He announced in 1835 that the coming of the Lord was nigh and that 56 years would wind up the scene. Well, he didn't live to find out that he'd guessed wrong, because he was in jail and somebody shot him before he learned that he had misfired as a prophet. Charles T. Russell, the founder of the Jehovah's Witness movement, set dates for the coming, not of the end. He announced in 1891 not a future date of the second coming, but that the Lord came invisibly in October of 1874. He just kind of snuck in and nobody knew about it. Now, you compare that to a display of God's power, for example, on Mount Sinai. When the mountain quaked and it terrified Moses, God's friend, and the people were so frightened they didn't even want to be in the proximity of where God's power was displayed. But Russell said, well, he just came and snuck in. The Lord said that his appearance would be as visible as lightning, And the apostle wrote that every eye would see him. Russell later changed the date from 1874 to another invisible coming in 1914. And you go through a series of dates that various Jehovah's Witness honchos set until they had gone through five dates and missed it. And after that, in 1995, the current boss, as far as I know, Robert Jackson, was not willing to give any new guess, but he said, we're living in the last days. He's quite confident of that, and that was recorded in Christianity Today. Now, Jesus said, nobody knows the date of the second coming. How many times have you heard that in these few days? A lot of times. Well, it was true then, and it's still true. And you had a man by the name of Hal Lensing from up around Dallas, very vigorously and strenuously and joyfully has presented the information concerning the second coming with great confidence. He said that Jesus would return within 40 years of 1948. In the book, The Late Great Planet Earth, came out in 1970, and the one that I'm about to try to work over came out as a reprint in 1980, and he's been tooling around with that since. A generation, he said, in the Bible is something like 40 years. If this is correct as a deduction, then within 40 years or so of 1948, all these things could take place. And then he says, to really clinch it, many scholars who have studied the Bible prophecies all their lives believe this is so. Well, that ought to settle it for us, I guess. And then he further asserts, all these signs and many more, which are just as visible, point to the fact that this generation is the one that will see the end of the present world and the return of Jesus Christ. We are the generation he was talking about. And that, he said in his book, Countdown to Armageddon. Harold Wissenhunt, following Lindsay's lead, published the little book I've heard different brethren refer to this week of 88 Reasons Why the Lord's Going to Come in 1988. Didn't come. But that didn't keep him from selling 6 million copies of that book. People love the spectacular. They love it so much that they'll buy a failure. They bought 25 million copies plus of Lindsay's book. And he's been wrong on everything he's ever predicted. Still wrong. Still writing books. People still buying it. I don't understand it. Billy Graham, in his book Till Armageddon, says, and I quote, there is no doubt that global events are preparing the way for the final war of history, the great Armageddon. Now the signs are everywhere that the world is preparing feverishly for World War III, which could be the last war, Armageddon. Boy, they were all excited when that thing cranked up over in the Persian Gulf, but George Bush and Norman Schwarzkopf and Colin Powell messed everything up because they won it in a week. Couldn't get to the printer in that time. I'm serious. A friend of mine led a rifle platoon in the 101st Airborne. They received an assignment to take a large, heavily fortified area where there were many, many weapons. And it was a key strategic thing. And he said, very seldom in modern warfare do you have the opportunity to have a whole division, 101st Airborne Division, in full battle array with all of their regalia marching across a desert like you did on that flat desert. But he said, that's what we did. And said, we took the higher ground and, of course, had the sun at their back. And said, those Iraqis looked up as they were cooking breakfast early one morning and looked into the eyes and down the barrels of all the guns of the 101st Airborne. And he said, some of those fellows were caught 2 days later by some Marines and said they were still running. Well, that did a terrible disservice to our premillennial friends. John von Voord, who is one of the real thinkers in this movement, said in his book, Armageddon, Oil, and the Middle East Crisis, our generation may well be the last before Christ returns. Current world events seem to be setting the stage for the events that will occur soon after the rapture. And if so, the rapture may be excitingly near. Now, he wrote that first in 74, and he retooled it and reissued it in 1990. Now, these are just a few samples of the thousands of people that you could cite who believe they have found in the Bible an outline of events that will take place in connection with the end time And they believe they found signs and what have you that would give them a map as to how you can discern these things, how they can specifically predict these things. Since Harold Lindsay, David asked me to look at several, but I got to looking at them, and I thought that's going to be such a shotgun approach that it might be better, and I hope this will be acceptable, that it might be better to look at one of these men. And I tried to cast about to see who that ought to be. Lindsay is the man that has popularized that view in our generation, I believe, to a greater degree than anybody else. There's, of course, there's Richard DeHaan, there's Billy Graham, there's Pentecost that several people have mentioned, Ball Vuard, many, many others. But how Lindsay can write, some of these fellows are so obtuse in their writing that nobody knows what they're talking about. Lindsay can take it, popularize it, people buy that and buy into the system. And so I thought it would be good to examine Lindsay's word. According to Lindsay, three things are going to have to occur before the end of time. Israel will have to be reinstated in its land. The Jews will take possession of Jerusalem, and they will rebuild the temple there. Now, then a number of powers, he says, are going to arise. Russia in the north, which is Gog and Magog of Scripture. Egypt and the Arabian alliance down south, which allegedly represents the kingdom of the south, described in Daniel 11. Red China in the east, the peoples of the east that are talked about in Revelation. And then the future furor that Brother Lewis referred to will appear, and the Antichrist from Rome, the leader of the 10-nation confederacy, is the form he'll take. Now, the righteous will be raised and taken into the rapture. There will be a great period of tribulation on the earth. During the last half of this period of tribulation, the final confrontation will take place. North against south. I was kind of like that one. And east against the west. In a place called Armageddon. And at the end of Armageddon, Jesus returns with his saints at the end of the rapture and sets up to his kingdom in Jerusalem and reigns there for 1,000 years. That's Lindsay's view. And that is pretty much the popular view. When you deal with Lindsay, you've pretty well dealt with all of them. The first acute problem with Lindsay's view that I would point out is to do with hermeneutics. The whole book of the late great planet Earth breaks two fundamental rules of interpretation. He ignores the nature of apocalyptic language. Just absolutely ignores that. This is a genre, apocalypse or apocalypse is a genre of literature that was employed. It was especially popular among the Jews, but among other people as well, during the first century period. Revelation is an apocalyptic drama. And the Old Testament, Daniel and Ezekiel, a little bit of Isaiah and Zechariah is representative of apocalyptic imagery. Uninspired writings like the Apocrypha and the Pseudepigrapha represent that style of writing. And they all have similarities. They're all written about a great conflict between good and evil. In this style of writing, nations are represented by animals. Numerical symbolism is used. Numbers like 3, 7, 10, and 12 are the most popular. And the theme of nearly every one of them is that even under the oppression and persecution of the devil, the righteous will prevail. It was never intended that this literature be literalized. Most people today absolutely and completely miss the book of Revelation because they do not understand that it was written as an apocalyptic drama and do not know what to do with it. They don't realize that it's figurative. And so they don't have an idea about how you approach that. Hal Lindsay makes the same mistake by trying to force these figurative apocalyptic passages into a literal and modern-day fulfillment. Lindsay's second hermeneutical problem is described as eisegesis. What in the world does that mean? Exegesis is where you get out of a text what's there. Eisegesis is where you pump into a text what you want to be there. And he's guilty of that. There's nothing in the context saying what it means many times, but Lindsay will come to a passage and he'll force his opinion upon it with total disregard for the historic situation, who the writer is talking to, when it was written, and what was involved when he was writing it. Instead of coming to the text for instruction from the writer, informed by its historical setting, He goes to the text and forces his own interpretation on those events and proceeds to mix one misinterpretation with another misinterpretation, links all that together and says what he wants to say. Now, if you grant him that liberty, if you let him misuse the Bible in that way, then he can make a pretty convincing case. Sounds good. Sounds good enough to sell over 25 million books. Sell lots of films, records. Now, there are several fatal flaws with Lindsay's view. First of all, when he talks about the restoration of Israel, he's wrong. Lindsay thinks he sees the prophecy of Israel's restoration to her homeland in modern times in Ezekiel 38. Now, in Ezekiel 38 and verse 8, the prophet says, "After many days thou shalt be visited, in the latter years thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword and is gathered out of my people against the mountains of Israel, which have been always waste, but it is brought forth out of the nations, and they shall dwell safely, all of them." How Lindsay points out that this prophecy was fulfilled when Israel was restored to her homeland on May the 14th, 1948, and he says this is the beginning of the last things. But if you go to the context of Ezekiel, it is obvious that this was not fulfilled in 1948. This is not talking about modern events. This passage was fulfilled in 536 B.C. In the context, the Jews have gone off into Babylonian captivity. And he's writing to those Jews who are captive in Babylon, and he tells the people, "You're going to come home. You're coming back to our land." In 536, the Jews did return. Cyrus made the decree, and Zerubbabel led them back, and this is all revealed to you in the book of Ezra. So Hal takes this passage, fulfilled in 536 B.C., and alleges that it was fulfilled in 1948 in modern times. That won't work. He also applies Matthew chapter 24, verses 32 through 34 to 1948. The Lord said, "Now learn a parable of the fig tree. When his branch is yet tender and putteth forth leaves, you know that the summer is nigh. So likewise, when he shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors. Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled." Mr. Lindsay alleges on page 53 of the late great Planet Earth, 1980 rendition, that the fig tree is a sign of the end of the world. When the Jews came back to the land in 48, the fig tree, he said, started to put on leaves. Well, imagine that. In Matthew 24, verses 32 through 34, Jesus is not talking about 1948. Jesus is talking about the destruction of Jerusalem that took place in AD 70. And he is there giving signs to the brethren to warn the people about the fall of Jerusalem. And he says, "Just as surely as you know the summer's near, when the tree puts on its leaves, you can tell when the end of Jerusalem in AD 70 is near when you see these signs come to pass." He goes on in verse 34 and says, "This generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled." Now, did the Lord lie? No, sir, he didn't lie. He's not capable of lying. He is the God-man. He didn't lie. Those events did take place. See, that generation that he was talking to passed away many centuries ago. But Mr. Lindsay comes along and takes this passage applying to AD 70 and the Ezekiel passage applying to 536 B.C. and mixes them up and alleges that this mixed up monstrosity teaches us that there's a prophecy that the Jews will return to their homeland in 1948. Now, that doesn't make good nonsense. He also fails to realize that in the New Testament, Israel is not a reference to the political entity that occupies the land where the kingdom of David used to be. It doesn't talk about them at all. That Israel was rejected by the Lord when Christ was rejected. God the Father rejected them when they rejected His Son. In the New Testament, Israel refers to His church. In Galatians chapter 6, verse 16, for example, the Lord makes such a statement. "And as many as walk according to this rule, peace be on them and mercy and upon the Israel of God." Who's He talking about? The church. Who's He writing to there? The church is of Galatia. Galatians 3 and verse 7, "Know ye therefore that they which are of faith, the same are the children of Abraham." Who's that? That's children of Israel. What Israel? The church. The true children of Abraham today are not the Israelis over in Palestine, but those who have faith in Jesus as the Christ. Romans 9 and verse 8 says, "They which are the children of the flesh, these are not the children of God, but the children of the promise are counted for seed." That is, those who accepted Christ are the children of promise. Now, the allegation that Jerusalem is going to be repossessed in fulfillment of biblical prophecy, a key plank in Lindsay and all of these fellows, as far as I know, scheme of things, is a fatal flaw. It's a fatal fallacy. Lindsay says that happened in June 67 when they retook the city of Jerusalem on page 55 of his book. The passage he says that proves this is found in Zechariah, prophecy of Zechariah chapters 12 through 14. Now, Zechariah 13 verse 1, you have him speaking about a fountain open for the cleansing for sin. He then tells of the Lord fighting on behalf of his people in chapter 14. In verses 1 through 5, he says, "Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee. For I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle. And the city shall be taken, and the houses rifled, and the women ravished, and half the city shall go forth into captivity, and the residue of the people shall be cut off from the city. Then shall the Lord go forth and fight against those nations, and when he fought in the day of battle, and his feet shall stand in the day and that day upon the Mount of Olives, which is before Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall cleave in the midst thereof toward the east and toward the west, and there shall be a great valley." It's going to split right down the middle of the mountain, he says. "And half of the mountain shall remove toward the north and half toward the south. And you shall flee to the valley of the mountains, for the valley of the mountains shall reach to Azal. Yea, ye shall flee like as ye fled from before the earthquake in the days of Uzziah, king of Judah. And the Lord my God shall come, and all the saints with thee." Now, if that was fulfilled when the Jews took Jerusalem in 1967, there is a problem. Because Mount Olive didn't split. You've been there. Is it split?
No, but God said that's where the Lord's coming.
Said that's where the Lord's coming. But now, if that is a fulfillment of the prophecy, why didn't the mountain split? Been there since 1967. He's had plenty of time to split it. It's not split. If it is to be fulfilled later when our Lord comes, then who's going to flee? The wicked aren't going to flee according to Lindsay because they're going to be dead. And the righteous are not going to flee according to his theory because they're going to be there to have all that fun in the rapture and a 1,000-year reign and everything. So who's going to flee? So old Hal's got himself in a terrible jam way down yonder in Jerusalem. So this passage doesn't predict the repossession of Jerusalem in our time as a fulfillment of prophecy. It's probably talking about the church. The cleansing for sins and the Lord's fighting for his people, referring to the victories of the church. Now, another fatal flaw is found in Mr. Lindsay's allegation that the temple will be rebuilt in Jerusalem. And a little problem there because you have the Dome of the Rock now standing where the temple used to be. Now, he argues that on pages 55 and 56. And he misuses Daniel chapter 9 in verse 27 to try to prove that point. There Daniel said, "And he shall confirm the covenant with many. For 1 week shall he cause the sacrifice and the oblation to cease. And for the overspreading of the abominations he shall make it desolate, even until the consummation. And that determined shall be poured upon the desolate." Lindsay's position is that the temple is going to be destroyed when the Antichrist shows up at the end of the world. Therefore, if the temple is going to be destroyed by the Antichrist, they got to get busy and build it before he gets here. In Daniel 9:27, the prophet is talking about AD 70, the destruction by the Romans. It's not even talking about the Antichrist and what he's going to do at the end of the world, or what anybody's going to do at the end of the world, or anything associated with the end of the world. Luke 21:20, the Lord spoke of a desolation and applied it to the destruction of Jerusalem at the hand of the Roman armies. Lindsay says that Ezekiel 40 through 48 predicts the rebuilding of the temple. A temple such as Ezekiel envisioned there never has been built. That kind of a temple was not built during the time of the return from exile. Therefore, since Ezekiel was not a false prophet, Lindsay maintains, this temple is going to be built in a near time. Very soon, he says, the last days. Now, if you look at the context of Ezekiel, chapters 40 through 48, you'd have to deny that interpretation. Because the theme of the last section of Ezekiel is, I have a dream. I don't know if Martin Luther King got that from Ezekiel or not, but that's his thing. I have a dream. And the temple, at the time he has this dream, has been destroyed and was desolate. The people have been carried off into captivity. Jerusalem's been burned to the ground. Ezekiel was envisioning, in this apocalyptic, figurative language, the return of the people in 536 B.C. and the rebuilding of the temple and the restoration of the Old Testament worship. And the temple was rebuilt in 516, and the worship was restored at that time, and Ezekiel's predictions were fulfilled. The very nature and purpose of the Old Testament would deny a time in the future when we're going to go back to animal sacrifices and the old priesthood and all that ritual that had to do with the law of Moses. Tommy brought it out today. And you're going to say that the blood of Jesus can't get the job done, so we're going to trade that in for the blood of a goat? That's what you've got to say. You have denigrated my Lord. That's a damnable heresy. That's a dangerous doctrine. It's blasphemy. The old law was taken out of the way. It was nailed to the cross. There's no place in the New Testament for restating and restoring these things. Have you not read the book of Hebrews? He's better than the angels. He's better than Moses. He's better than the law. He's got a better sacrifice, a better sanctuary, and a better covenant. The misidentification of Gog and Magog in Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39 is a fatal flaw that many of these writers make. Mr. Lindsay makes it. He argues that on pages 59 through 57. He says Gog and Magog are the enemy from the north. Russia, who will come down and fight in the land of Israel. And he makes a convincing case for some of these terms that are used in Ezekiel 38. The Lord said in 38 verse 2, Son of man, set thy face against God, the land of Magog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal, and prophesy against him. Other versions, such as the New American Standard, read the prince of Rosh. And we've never discovered a land named Rosh. But Lindsay knows what it is. Rosh is Russia. Well, sure. Why did I say that? The word Rosh in Hebrew means chief or head, and more than likely it should be translated just like the King James translates it, when it says the chief prince of Meshech. You can take Meshech, though, and mess around with it a little bit and come out with Moscow. Rosh is Russia, and Meshech is Moscow. There it is. And he even quotes Wilhelm Gesenius, who said it probably could be Moscow. And Gesenius further suggested that Tubal represented the Tiberni, a group of people living by the Black Sea. And we know that the Russians control that. Well, that all, see, it links up. If you'll grant all that kind of stuff, Ezekiel chapter 38, verses 5 and 6 list the allies of Russia. Ethiopia, Libya would form the Black African Confederation, except most people in Libya are not black, but it's not my theory. Persia would join the alliance. The African countries are going to join, support Russia for a while. This is Lindsay talking, not Linda. Gomer represented the descendants of Japheth, who settled in Europe, and these represent the Iron Curtain countries that have since been set free, but there again, they're going to have to retool a little. So there's Russia, Black Africa, Persia, and the Iron Curtain countries all joining together called Gog of the land of Magog. And they're going to come down from the north and they're going to fight against the land of Israel. And again, you must remember that Ezekiel 38 and 39, brethren, is apocalyptic imagery. It's apocalyptic drama. Gog and Magog represent the enemies of God's people. Chapter 39 in Ezekiel tells us how God's going to destroy them. Ezekiel wrote this when Israel was in Babylonian captivity. They're in Babylon. That's what he's talking about. And it was fulfilled when God's judgment fell on the Babylonians. In the book, Ezekiel condemned all of Israel's enemies except Babylon by name. It is hard, in fact, it's impossible for me to believe that he would make no reference to Israel's primary enemy when he talks about all the secondary enemies, but he's not going to name the one that's got them captive. He spoke of God's judgment on Babylon under the figure of Gog and Magog. In Hebrew, there's a possible wordplay where Magog stood for Babylon. The background for Gog and Magog comes from Genesis 10. In Genesis 10, you have a table of nations where most of these terms are found. Genesis 10, verse 2 reads, "The sons of Japheth, Gomer, and Magog, and Madai, and Javan, and Tubal, and Meshech." So Ezekiel goes back, picks up these terms signifying the hordes of the Gentiles who at that point in time were ruled over by the Babylonians. So Gog and Magog undoubtedly represent the enemies of God's people in the days of Ezekiel. Gog and Magog also appear symbolically representing the enemies of God's people in Revelation 20 and verse 8. "And shall go out to deceive the nations which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, the number of whom is as the sand of the sea." Now the Lord will destroy them as he destroyed the Babylonians in the Old Testament. So in the Old Testament, as in the New Testament, Gog and Magog are symbolic of the enemies of God's people. There is no Bible reference anywhere equating Russia or Moscow with any of this material that Ezekiel and other prophets are dealing with. Lindsay notes that Israel is to be invaded from the north. And he said, you know, Russia's north of Israel. He knows geography. And so that must be the enemy in the north that the prophets are talking about. And when you look at Babylon, if you know geography, you know it's due east. Oh my, we've got a problem here, don't we? No, not at all. Because if they had invaded from the east, they had to walk across 300 miles of desert. Nobody did that in antiquity. That'd be hard to do with a Humvee. That'd be hard to do in a tank. It'd be nearly impossible to do walking, so they walked up the Euphrates River Valley and came down the Mediterranean coast and attacked from the north, always. Always came from the north. So that old boat won't float. Ezekiel lived and wrote at the same time that Jeremiah did. And Jeremiah, it talks about Babylon coming from the north. They're contemporaries of each other. The enemy from the north is Babylon. They did come from the north to invade the land. God did bring his judgment upon them, just like Ezekiel predicted in Ezekiel chapters 38 and 39. Lindsay misidentifies the king of the south in Daniel 11 as the Arabian Confederation, mainly Egypt. He argues that on pages 72 through 80. Daniel tells of the battle between the king of the north and the king of the south. The king of the north is the king of Egypt in the intertestamental period, the line of rulers known as the Ptolemies. The king of the north, south is the king of, the south rather is Egypt, and the king of the north is Syria, the Seleucids, such as Antiochus Epiphanes and Seleucus the first, second, and third, and so on. So here in the book of Daniel, the war between the Ptolemies and the Seleucids is described. In Daniel 11, beginning at verse 40, there is a passage that nobody's found an accurate fulfillment for yet. Daniel described the exploits of Antiochus Epiphanes, one of the Seleucids, down to verse 39. In chapter 11 and verse 40, the prophet says, "And at the time of the end shall the king of the south push at him, and the king of the north shall come against him like a whirlwind with chariots and with horsemen and with many ships, and he shall enter into the country and shall overflow and pass over." Now, Lindsay identifies the king of the south as Egypt and the king of the north as Russia, but nothing in the Bible identifies the king of the north as Russia. It is possible that Daniel 11, verses 40 through 45, is talking about Rome's invasion of Egypt. The activities of Antiochus Epiphanes are described accurately right down to verse 39. He never invaded Egypt, but coming right on the heels of him, Rome did and came from the north. Now I've got to move quickly. I've only got 6 minutes and 23 seconds. Lindsay is fatally flawed in his misidentification of the people of the east. Two passages in Revelation, Revelation 9 and 16, and Revelation 16 and 12 are used. And Revelation 9 verse 16 says, "The number of the army of the horsemen were 200,000,000, and I heard the number of them." Well, what country could field an army of 200 million? Well, the Chinese, obviously, the only people who got that many folks. Of course, it says they're horsemen, but we'll let that slide. 200 million. Bob Sweeten's here. He was a logistics man in the army, working with a military police battalion. Get him to tell you about how much trouble it's going to be to move 200 million people anywhere at one time and feed them and have water and sewage and post office and all the things that you've got to have to move an army. That's right, brethren. You don't just plop them down any old place. When we went over to the Persian Gulf, I didn't know there were that many trucks in America that came through Livingston on the way to Houston. They moved those things for months. 200 million Chinese. And then you got all these other folks, the Russians and everybody else. That constitutes his next fatal flaw. The future Führer is the Antichrist who will set up his headquarters in Rome and lead a 10-nation confederacy. And Lindsay just going hog wild and peg crazy because the European common market's coming together and talking about a common currency, except the British are not going to do it because the Irish and the Scotch are not going to let them. But Lindsay thinks, boy, it's already started. Man, there it is. There it is. Well, he gets into Daniel chapter 7 and misapplies the literature that talks about the beast and what have you. And I don't have time to go into that. My time is fast getting away. But you just go down through and through and through. And look at all of these kinds of things where he misapplies the apocalyptic imagery that's dealt with. Gets into the number of the 666 and they go crazy. In Revelation chapter 13, his number is 666. What in the world is that? Well, it could be a gematria. That's where you give the letters of a man's name numerical value, and that's his number. And if you change Nero Caesar's name to Hebrew, it'll add up, but I don't know why you would do that and what rule you would apply to do that. I think 666, this is the world according to Lindell. Six was the number of wickedness, evil. And 666 is the way of saying he was a really snotty, wicked man. Bad guy, David. Mean man. That's what he's saying. Evil personified. Now, in the first century, Christians were dying by the thousands at the hands of the Roman Caesar. And that's when, in the context of Revelation, who's he talking to? He's talking to people that are dying at the hands of Caesar. What good is it going to do to tell them that 1,000 years from now or 2,000 years from now, some guy named Benito Mussolini or Henry Kissinger or somebody else that they don't know and don't care, you know, and we're going to cloud up and rain all over him, but y'all can just die. How's that going to help in their context? Don't you see? He has a fatal flaw in saying that the future Führer is going to come to prominence, and then they're going to have a rapture. Problem with the rapture is it's not in the Bible. It's like the brother said here the other day, you know, if I wrote my chapter, it wouldn't take long. It's not in there. It's not there. There's nothing in Scripture about that. But Lindsay tries to apply passages to talk about the end time when Jesus is going to take his people to heaven and apply that to a rapture. You find the rapture in there for me. He's fatally flawed in seeing a final great conflict. The only appearance of Armageddon in the Bible is Revelation 16:16. It describes God's judgment on the wicked and the salvation of the righteous, and he gathered them together into one place in the Hebrew tongue called Armageddon. Armageddon literally means hill of Megiddo. Har in the Hebrew means hill or mountain. Hill of Megiddo is a famous battleground. In Tennessee, you'd say Shiloh. In Texas, you'd say the Alamo. In Mississippi, you'd say Bryce's Crossroads. In Arkansas, you'd say Pea Ridge.
No, we lost that.
Lost that. In Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, you'd say Gettysburg. It's a famous battlefield. Armageddon is where Deborah and Barak defeated Sisera and the Canaanites. It's where Josiah was killed by the Emperor Necho of Egypt and may have determined the rule of the Fertile Crescent. But listen, what are you going to do in a little old battlefield that is from antiquity? You can't put 200 million Chinese on that battlefield naked with no equipment or anything. They won't fit. But you see, when a man goes to war, he's carrying a rifle, he's got on a big helmet, and he's got a pack, and he's got body armor, and he's got all this junk he's carrying. 100 pounds of stuff. You can't put him on there with nothing. Empty-handed. 200 million men will not fit in Megiddo. Much less the Chinese and the Russians and the Europeans and everybody else who thinks he might want to fight. It won't work. Now, these are fanciful things. The Lord never intended for that to be taken. Literally, it symbolized a great conflict, a spiritual conflict, in which God's judgment would be given. Lindsay and scores just like him have taken disconnected passages, superimposed their opinions on them, and tried to force them to fit together. The Word of God does not tell us when the Lord's going to come back, nor does it provide any signs. The only thing the Lord said about the end of the world is, you don't know when I'm coming, so you better be ready when I get there. And the only way in the world to get ready is to become a Christian. If you believe that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, then the thing for you to do is repent and turn from sin. To come confess His blessed name and be buried with Him in baptism for the remission of sins, to rise, to walk the new life. Don't waste your time out here with all these fancy tales. Don't waste your money buying these books and all of that paraphernalia that they have when God said they don't know what they're talking about, when they've already misfired, and the Lord said when a man misses it, don't fear him. I tell you who you better fear. You better fear the one with whom we have to do. You better fear the one that sits at the right hand of the throne of glory and power, because when He comes back again, He's going to come back in flaming fire, taking vengeance on them that know not God and obey not the gospel. You don't want to be in that number. Come to Christ on His terms. Come obey the gospel tonight. Come renouncing sin as together we stand and sing.